tally ho, guten tag, and top of the morning to all you delightful ding dongs, both here stateside and particularly abroad, because today is the day where we celebrate our top listener nations in 10 countries, 10 mysteries. And of course, there's no way I'd rather go on another one of these awesome journeys without my best good pal, Chris from the 80s High podcast. Welcome back, sir.
I am so thrilled that we are back to talk about these countries because we recorded the cities episode like 3 months ago. It feels like so long. And we've had these countries like in the hopper and we've, you know, for a variety of reasons, just put it off. So I am ecstatic that we finally are here recording and get to talk about these mysteries because I got to know. I have been waiting. What are your mysteries?
And I'm sure you're feeling the same way. Yeah. Because just like last time, we did not. Did I even say what my friggin' name is? I'm Allison Dixon, by the way. Did I even say that? I don't know. I don't care. You know, y'all know who I am. If you don't know who I am, and whatever.
That's
you
just right. That's
scroll
right.
on, listen on. But, but yeah, so just like in the 10 Cities episodes, we kept our secrets. We didn't know what we covered for each one. And so it was really exciting to do the live reveal as we were going. But it was really cool to know, too, how close we came to overlapping on a couple of ours in the States ones. Like there was, you did flying saucers, the first flying saucer sighting in Seattle. And then I nearly did the hangar Area 51 thing right. here in Dayton.
Right.
And so it was like, oh, my God, that would have really dovetailed very nicely. But we didn't. And Chris is a little worried that we might have an overlap, but I think we'll be okay. So we have I think we should have a gentleman's bet to see if we run into that as we progress. And as before, these are two part. This is going to be in two parts. We're going to do the bottom five and then the top five in the next episode.
Yeah. And we'll find out pretty quickly if we overlap because it's my second country, as a matter of fact,
okay.
is the one I'm worried about. So we'll right. uncover that bonus mystery pretty quickly.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. It's a bonus mystery. But I want to also say first off, too, that as I said in the first of the 10 Cities episodes, is that I was shocked that we even have this many countries listening to this show. So I am thrilled for all of you international listeners who are tuning in and hopefully enjoying yourselves. So Chris has the first country on the list, which is number 10.
Yeah.
So we're going in reverse order. So who do we have for our number 10?
We're kicking off with our friends in Norway.
Ooh,
so very exciting. And I have to tell you, there were some like pretty tempting mysteries here. One of them was actually covered on a fairly recent season of the new Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, very nice.
There's the Oslo Plaza woman, Jennifer Fairgate, and there's also the Easdal woman. So there's like a couple of these like big mysteries of women who are found dead. There's this whole spy angle. They're not sure what's going on. I almost did that one. But what I didn't do in the cities one that I wanted to do here was actually an unsolved murder.
Ooh.
And so I have, which I guess technically those are as well, but I found one that's a little different. And I want to talk about the unsolved case of Trude Espace.
Okay.
So despite several investigations, Norwegian police still don't know who killed Trude Espace in the tourist hotspot of Geiranger back in 1996.
Okay, 96. That's taken us back a little ways.
So we're going back a little ways. And this is like one of the most picturesque spots in all of Norway. I think if people have never been to the country, but they've seen something on Instagram or they think of what Norway looks like with these beautiful fjords, these lovely snow-capped mountains and everything just like blending together in this beautiful like epic scenery. That's Geiranger. And it is, again, home to this spectacular scenery, and it's actually been named the best travel destination in Scandinavia by Lonely Planet. And since 2005, the Geirangerfjord area has been listed as an UNESCO World Heritage Site. So this is kind of the setting where this takes place. And because this is a tourist spot, there are several hundred thousand people who pass through this village during tourist season, which takes place roughly from May to September. And tourism is really a main business for this town of only about 250 permanent residents.
That is a family, like a large family.
Yeah, with a massive influx of in-laws, you might say, with all right. of these tourists coming in. So that's a little bit of the setting where the story takes place. Now let's talk about Truda. So on July 31st, 1996, she arrives in Geiranger to work a seasonal job at Hotel Union. She's a 20-year-old. She's from Norway. And she was only in the tourist village for about a week when the unthinkable happened.
Oh, that's really sad.
So July 31st, she arrives. On August 8th, Truda has the day off of work. She's walking around town. She runs some errands. And eventually she finds her way out of the town center to this rock that's kind of alongside the road. And it's near the fjord. So beautiful scenery. And she sits on this rock to read a book. Well, the next morning, Truda does not show up for work. And for 11 days, no one knew what happened to her.
Now, can you remind me again how old she is?
She's 20 years old.
20. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So I believe she was studying, I want to say it was literature. So university student, taking that summer seasonal job, you know, beautiful location, probably making some extra money, all that good stuff. And she disappears. She's been seen reading this book on the rock. And then next day, she doesn't show up to work. Mm. So, you know, a coworker is concerned and they start to do a search pretty immediately. And they search and they search. 11 days. No trace of Truda until her body is found hidden under rocks in the grass, only meters away from where she had last been seen.
This kind of reminds me a little bit about the very recent case in the UK of the woman who was reading on a bench next to a river. And then she, I guess she, well, she, I don't know if she was reading. I think she was on a conference meeting, like on Teams or Zoom okay. or something on her phone. And she set her phone down and she had her dog with her. And she gets up and is never seen again after that. And they ended up finding her in the river, actually. That's where they did most of their search. And some people are saying she very likely fell in, but they think it's still really weird, the circumstances. So people listening right now might be familiar with that one. It was kind of in the news a couple months ago as of this recording.
I hadn't heard of that one, but it's definitely one of those eerie stories where somebody is seen and then like, and there's a lot of eyewitnesses, and then they disappear, but nobody really knows what happened. And right. it's really like in a blink of an eye. And we're going to learn kind of how this unfolds as we talk about this case, because the authorities do spring into action. And this is a stunningly comprehensive investigation. The full case file includes some 10,000 documents. Over 3,000 witnesses from almost 40 countries are questioned. There's over 2,000 tips that come in, and the police pore over more than 11,000 tourist photos or videos that were taken to try to find some clue of what happened to Truda. But still to this day, no arrests or suspects have been linked to her murder.
Oh, that kind of reminds me of Tara Grinstead, even though they hadn't found her at the time. But when you talk about the size of the case file down in Georgia that they had developed over the course of her missing persons case for so many years, and they just couldn't put it all together.
Right.
Yikes. That's sad.
Yeah. So let's talk about this investigation a little bit. So local police mapped all of the identities of people and vehicles that were in Geiranger on the day of the murder. And at that time, there were nearly 5,000 people in the town. So basically, of everyone who's in that town, 98% are tourists. So you can imagine that's a very daunting task to get any kind of manifests of, you know, cruise ships that are docked there and have tourists. But, you know, some people are entering in their own vehicles and campers and stuff like that. So this is a pretty monumental task of mapping out 5,000 people and their vehicles. Guest lists from hotels, campsites were collected, even like data from debit and credit card use. So again, the police do an amazing job of really poring over any and all information they can get. And anyone who's been observed in Garangaran that day in question is also registered by the police. So really thorough, super thorough. But again, because there's so many tourists, they can come and go freely. You know, they can leave without a trace. And that's kind of where we find ourselves. Now, several witnesses, both on foot and in cars, saw Truda sitting on the rock reading a book the day she went missing. So let's talk about a few of these folks. Most notably is the Swedish couple. So a Swedish couple from Uppsala are regular visitors to Garangar, and they took a walk to a fjordside campsite. And they saw a girl sitting on the rock reading, whom both they and the police are sure is Truda. So they take this little walk. On their return, they note that the girl is no longer sitting there. And the man decides he wants to go up the trail a little ways to use the restroom to relieve himself. They're not near like a town. They're still kind of out in a more remote site, if you will. And mm-hmm. they hear a scream. And the man's kind of concerned. So he goes to look and he follows the trail a bit of the way. And he looks down this path and he perceives what looks like a man and a child playing. And so he just kind of assumes, okay, they were playing, you know, the kids screamed, whatever, like, you know, how kids are. If you're like, hey, I'm going to get you, I'm going to tickle you, you know, there's a bit of a scream, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes to take care of his call of nature. And when he comes back, he notes that the pair that he had seen earlier are no longer where he saw them. And what's chilling is the place where Trude's body is found is just 20 meters uphill from where this incident took place.
That is really interesting because this was around the same time. She was nearby. There was a scream. I always wonder if they heard the scream, the guy and the kid, if they were questioned on that or...
Well, there's some speculation that maybe this was Truda and the man misperceived a child as actually a young woman who could have been laying on the ground or just in a position where, you know how perception works if you look down away. The man does mention after the fact that, the husband of the Swedish couple mentions that the man looks over at him and it's a very kind of creepy look that kind of stuck with him. Yeah. And you have to imagine that it's quite possible he may have witnessed the beginning of her murder and not even realized it until it was too late.
That's chilling.
Which is an awful thought. Mm-hmm. The man in question wore a blue and white striped shirt. And there was a man with the same description that had asked another person about the time, just a few hundred meters from where Trude was last seen. And this man spoke German. So the thinking is this man that the Swedish couple saw and the person who asked someone else for the time could be the same person. Well, what they later find out is that a man with the same description was actually seen about 500 meters from where Trude was when she's sitting on the rock. And he comes up to an employee of the hotel and is behaving very strangely. He's sitting still and staring at this young woman for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's a long time. That is a long time to have somebody like if we've all been in that situation where like you keep making eye contact with somebody or whatever. And so you like you're trying to go about your business, but you can't not help look. Imagine every time you look up for 20 minutes.
I would like, be so
this podcast
out.
Has not been 20 minutes so far. So that's an indication of how long that would be. We're not even there yet. So. Very chilling. And then eventually he gets up and asks her the time in German. And then he ends up walking toward the rocks where we later come to know that's where Trude was sitting. So basically this woman has this creepy encounter. He walks in the direction of Truda. And then later the Swedish couple sees this man with a blue and white striped shirt and what he perceives to be a child. So is this all the same man, same encounter?
Oh, my God. I can't help but escape the notion that if this were the modern day, there wouldn't be a mystery. There would be cameras. There would be geofencing warrants to get, you know, to see who was in the area, because he would almost certainly have a phone, you know, things like that, kind of technology that just wasn't around back then. So,
yeah. And so as I mentioned, the police end up obtaining thousands of photos from tourists in the area. They're trying to find anything that might give them a clue.
So they really did kind of do the best they could do without that technology, getting all those pictures. And that would be a challenge to do here.
I struggle to think what else they could have done. It was like, nobody, I think, can really fairly criticize this department and the work that they had been doing to really try to figure out what happened to this woman who was not only murdered, but as far as I could tell, also raped. So raped and murdered. Okay. So one particular photo catches their eye, and it's of a tourist who's looking out at the fjord. It's this very beautiful, picturesque scene, as you might imagine somebody would take if they're visiting. And it's about 5:15 p.m. on the day Truda disappears. And it's very blurry. It's very far away. But it appears that someone is sitting on that rock where she was last seen. In fact, they see a red dot in that location in this picture, if you really try to enhance it. And wouldn't you know, Truda was wearing a red shirt on the day she was murdered.
Oh.
So this really helps them get a precise time based on sightings of when she would have left that location.
Right, right.
So they know it wasn't before 5:15 p.m., she would have left by the time that the Swedish couple come back from that hike.
And could have very well been with the person that they spotted with him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's another clue. And then we have Truda's diary entry, this cryptic diary entry. So she's, you know, there for the summer. She's staying in kind of like a hotel dormitory with other seasonal workers. And she's keeping kind of a regular diary of what's going on. And I can associate with what she does. She writes notes like on little scraps of paper and then later translates that into her diary. Mm-hmm, so, you know, she's at work, she's out and about, she just jots something down like on a, you know, imagine a napkin or a, you know, a piece of paper that you got a pastry from, and she's going to put that all into her diary later. Well, this one particular note has a few words and it says German crutches. So they're like, interesting. Hold on a minute. This is like a day before she disappears is when this comes up. And so now they're thinking, okay, well, is this related? We know that this man in the blue and white striped shirt spoke German. We have this indication of German. Is this somebody who is perhaps following her, trying to engage with her, whatever? And they're like, crutches. Well, this wouldn't be the first person who tries to get sympathy from women by having a fake injury.
Ted Bundy.
Mr. Bundy is probably the most classic example of that.
Yes.
So is this something perhaps that was going on? So again, the police have this theory. The killer may have used the fact that Trude was a caring person. Maybe the use of the crutches, that's the pretext to get her away from the road, help him out, or whatever. Well, it all kind of fizzles there. And then somewhat out of nowhere, 20 years later in Germany, so this is 2017, there is a German detective show where they feature a reconstruction of this event. Again, they think they have this German connection. And so they're going to feature it in this TV show and ask for information. And after the show airs, they receive from somebody, hey, I have a photo that might be of interest. And the photo shows a man on crutches at the ferry dock in Geiranger, but he appears to have a missing leg.
Oh.
And the date of the photo was taken the same date that Truda made the diary note about German crutches.
Could I ask, did she have any blunt trauma? Anything that would suggest she was beaten with anything?
I have not been able to find details of the state of her body.
Okay.
In fact, I did not know that she was sexually assaulted until I read a few more things. Like, that wasn't heavily publicized in all of the articles that I found.
Okay, gotcha.
So I don't know too much about the manner of how she was killed.
And a lot of times countries don't release that stuff at all. It right. really depends on where. Some places like the UK, you can usually get some pretty grisly details, but
right.
A place like places in Scandinavia or other smaller countries, maybe not.
So again, we have this photo potentially leaking to her diary note. And then there's a 16-year-old girl who's working in a kiosk. She described a German man on crutches missing a leg as behaving very strangely on that same day. She reported that he was lingering about, asking in-depth questions. Again, we had the lingering of this other man as right. the young woman is, like, you know, hanging out on the rocks. So is this the same person? Is this just a coincidence? I mean, the police are a bit skeptical because could someone in that physical condition have been capable of murder and concealing a body? Because the body is found uphill from where she was last seen. So it's yeah. on an incline. And by all accounts, the man in this photo has one leg. He's not just cleverly disguising it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really hard to tell. And that's really where this mystery comes to a halt. Since 2017, there have not really been leads. The hope is that perhaps DNA analysis could yield results. Some of it has been attempted, but really it's not gotten anywhere so far. So maybe newer technology, we might finally get a lead. Or maybe someone else can come forward if this story gets told and retold and reshared so that Trude's family can hopefully finally get some answers. But that's where it sort of ends right now.
My initial thoughts on the two, what you said made an impression where you talk about the location of her body, his condition as having only one leg and a crutch. How do you pull that off? Especially, I could almost see if it was a luring somebody into a trap, you could, and you don't have to take them anywhere, you just leave them there. But if she was moved, that presents a quandary that I'm not sure. But the other guy, that nobody else who saw the guy in the blue and white shirt notice any physical conditions like a crutch or a missing leg.
Well, and that's a great point. So that man who was spotted with the shirt was wearing shorts, and there was no indication that his leg was either missing or that he had like a prosthetic leg or anything like that. Because one theory was like, well, maybe he had a prosthetic leg and he removed it, you know, at some point. But you would think if that would probably be noticeable. Especially in 1996, if there was an artificial limb, that would probably be something somebody would note if they witnessed this man around town.
Agreed. And it seems like if she noticed him, the one-legged man and made a little note to jot something down in her diary, she could have very well been thinking, you know, sort of like using that creative writer brain, you know, you see something unusual, like a man on a boat with one leg. It looks like he's a tourist, but he's alone. And it's like she's having, you know, like, I want to write about this later, you know, and kind of ponder what his experience would be like. And right. so she makes that little note to herself to, you know, expound upon that later. And maybe that's just kind of a red herring beyond that point, you know, whereas the other guy, I don't know. I mean, my guess is as good as anybody else's based on the amount of information available. But wow, that's it's one of those that, yeah, it's frustrating because it does feel like modern technology could have solved this possibly, but maybe still it could solve it. If you could get just enough of the right information, somebody goes and pours over all the details. I mean, admittedly, they have a lot of material that can be absolutely. Poured over. So there's like, you feel like there's got to be a needle in that particular haystack.
Yeah. And it's hard to know, like, how many of the tourists of those 5,000 were German. Is it just happenstance that these two things happen? But it's one of those when it's like, when you have this preponderance of evidence and those are the interesting overlapping dovetailing clues, you can't not help but focus on them.
Right.
But I do want to revisit that idea on our next episode because I have another case where I think we're going to find out that sometimes things that seem very well linked together may, in fact, maybe nothing more than just happenstance, even though they seem not to be. And so I think that's going to be an interesting, not pairing with this case, but just a way to kind of tie these together in how we think about unsolved mysteries, missing and murdered people. Because there's a lot out there, and in the absence of answers, particularly with this much evidence, it's really easy to go into some conspiratorial, grandiose explanations. And so,
but
that's where we leave it. And so, if you want to hear a bit more about this case, obviously we'll have some show notes, but there's a Scandinavian true crime podcast called Scream. That's spelled S-K-R-I-M, where they had some great coverage of this. And certainly if you are listening and you would have any tips on that rare situation where maybe you happen on this and know something, you should contact the Sunmore Police Department.
Very good. Very good.
All right.
You know, as a little segue, you know, when we're talking about our countries, our list of countries, before we started recording and noticing, you know, we have a few. We're not going to spoil it too much, but, you know, we have a few countries from this part of the world that listen to this show and can't remember which Scandinavian country it is. I want to say it's Sweden, but they celebrate true crime in a very big way up there, like where they just basically snuggle up and in their quaint little cabins over the winter and just devote everything to reading true crime novels and or murder novels. It's very much a celebration. They love these kinds of mysteries and stories. And I think there's a real, you know, you don't have hear about a lot of crimes up there, but they like to read about them and discuss them. So I am hopeful, you know, maybe getting a little more word about some of this stuff. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I like to say the climate in Sweden is very similar to Seattle. And so there's just something about the gloom and stuff that, I don't know, seems to attract people to true crime. I'm not sure.
It's the cursed latitude.
Yeah.
really is.
Absolutely.
And we're not going to go too far from Norway to our next case, are we?
We sure aren't, because we're sticking in the region. Yeah. And we're going to head on over to Denmark.
Yeah. I don't know. Do they say yeah in Denmark?
I'm gonna guess no.
I don't know. All the Danish listeners right now are just going, oh my god.
Unless that was a Minnesotan who moved to Denmark. Oh yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, you betcha. does the crime in Denmark have anything to do with actor Mads Mikkelsen, by any chance whatsoever?
It does not.
Oh, okay. Because the crime is that he's not on this show hanging out with us right now.
That is the true crime. That's the true crime.
The true mystery out of Denmark is, why doesn't he know who I am?
That's right. Well, you know what? This mystery is pretty old. 2,000 years old, as a matter of fact. Because I want to talk about the unsolved mystery of bog bodies.
My novel that I'm currently writing took a lot of inspiration from this topic.
You're familiar. So this is the one I was afraid that some of your countries might have been the overlap. But it sounds like, based on your reaction, we did not overlap.
We didn't.
Oh,
the
lovely.
Mystery.
Good.
Bonus mystery has been solved.
Great. Well, dear listeners, something is indeed rotten in the state of Denmark, or perhaps more so, well-preserved, because we can only speculate why these ancient humans, whose perfectly preserved bodies have been discovered in bogs, mires, and moors across northern Europe, and were violently murdered.
As an aside, when you said bogs and mires, I was thinking of the Myers Bogs test. You
like
know,
Myers Briggs? Myers-Boggs.
The Myers-Boggs test. That's a totally different thing.
That's amazing.
It'll show like how long you will last when buried in a bunch of peat. Yeah, for sure.
Love it.
Anyway.
So who were these people? Well, there are modern archaeologists who believe that folks from the Iron Age were sacrificial victims, killed and then delicately deposited in the bog as a ritualistic offering to the gods. Other scholars speculate that they were, in fact, criminals, immigrants, or wayfarers, ne'er-do-wells who met an untimely end. Well, regardless of who they are, forensics and modern autopsies have revealed that almost all of them, and these are men and women, met a violent end, some with finely wrought nooses around their necks, others with horrifically slashed necks, strangled, hanged, stabbed, sliced, clobbered on the head. In fact, some victims seem to have been killed in multiple ways. and the term is literally overkill for what? Some of the coinciding injuries that would have been fatal.
What was the name of this site again? Do you have a name for it?
There are modern, or there are many. So there's a couple different ones. There's Tallinn, Elling, okay. Grabal, and Haraldsskær.
Tallinn is the one that I'm most familiar with. Yeah. There's like a Tallinn band, I think, is the one that a lot of people would have heard of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So again, scholars who are looking into this are understandably, you know, that provokes a lot of speculation. Really, there's no end to it. Why would you stab someone in the throat and then strangle them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Denmark has one of the highest concentrations of bogs and bog bodies, many perfectly preserved over the centuries by the acids generated by sphagnum moss.
Yes.
Sphagnum moss?
Sphagnum. Mm-hmm.
The living foundations of these wetlands. And most of these bodies were accidentally discovered during turf harvesting. And this is really between 1800 and 1960. This is when Denmark is burning peat as fuel. So they are harvesting these bogs in these areas, and that is when they stumble across these bodies. So again, well-preserved, 2,000 years.
Fantastic. Wow. I mean, it's not fantastic, but it's fantastic that you can find something like this.
Absolutely.
After 2,000 years.
Yeah. So how do you solve this mystery? Well, it's pretty challenging, right? Because, well, for a few reasons. Very little is known about Iron Age Denmark. At this time in history, there's no written language, so we don't have any texts. Also, there's few written texts of Romans and Greeks that have survived to this day, which could have perhaps illuminated these rituals or practices that were going on. Also an issue, the majority of Iron Age people were, in fact, cremated. So we're not quite sure why these folks met a very different end than their contemporaries.
Just family disputes, man. Somebody just had enough.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you could have a field day of wondering what exactly is that difference. Is it something, you know, is it a ritual? Is it something that was venerated, or is it something that was reviled? And you met this unfortunate end because, again, you were a bad person, you know,
right,
in this society in this time. So as you can imagine, in the absence of these clear answers, myth-making and fancy kind of rush in to fill that void, as you know, I mentioned just a little bit ago. So it's not just bodies that are being found in these bogs. There's also these interesting artifacts. There's Roman coins. They're inscribed with swords. There's also swastika brooches. So this is interesting. You know, people might be like, well, hey, wait a second. You know, historically, swastikas predate the Nazi Party. And it was a very different symbol than how it was twisted by the Nazi Party. So swastikas existed at this time frame.
Yeah, and they're very common in a lot of Buddhist and Southeast Asian Buddhism.
That's right.
Especially. So you'll see a lot of that even in their temples today.
Yeah, and I think in addition to the symbol, aren't there like dots that are kind of interspersed in between them, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So part of the thinking is, well, maybe these are votive offerings, perhaps to Iron Age gods or deities. But again, we're just speculating at this point. So there are a few of these people who have been identified, and many of them are on display at museums in Denmark and, you know, several other countries. So there's the, and I'm going to mispronounce these, I apologize, Danish listeners. So there's the Haraldsskær woman. She was found naked next to her cloak. She was pinned down by tree branches, probably after she died. Grooves on her neck suggest strangulation. Her thin, leathery body. Her body is thin and leathery, and the expression on her face looks like a fixed state of shock. These are very terrifying. Oh. Like, you can almost, I mean, you can go look these up. You can see photos of them. They almost look like they are made of bronze. Like the way that they are preserved.
Yeah. And every detail is like leathery is another really great way to put it. Have you ever been to any sort of mummy exhibit of any kind?
I'm sure I have. I've been to the Smithsonian. I was in middle school. I'm almost certain I have been. I don't have a recollection.
Yeah. A few years ago, my family and I went down to the Natural History Museum outside Cincinnati at Union Station, and they had a mummies type exhibit, and they had specimen or specimens or however, whatever you refer to them as, these mummies, types of bog people on display there. And it's very quiet and a very somber environment because, you know, they are very careful to remind you that these were real people and be respectful. And so you really kind of feel like you're at a very quiet funeral as you're walking. You find, kind of find your hands clasped behind your back as you're just kind of strolling along and looking down. And it really is very much like looking at a carbon copy of a person. They've just been solidified into place and their skin's darker, like you said, bronzed. And you see everything. They almost look like they were just frozen in life. It's quite something.
Absolutely. And that's a very similar description to, I was reading one of the articles and they were, you know, somebody who was visiting several of these sites and talking to, you know, the museum curators and, you know, preservationists and, you know, archaeologists and so forth. And that sense of calm that you get where you're like, you can't not help but just be sort of drawn into the moment and overcome with this sense of just, I don't know what the word is, but you're just sort of, you're completely drawn into it and just silent. I think silence.
And maybe like you're kind of humbled by it a little bit because you're like, that was a person living their life like we're living our life. And a lot of times I find myself like thinking that that could be one of us one day in some display of like, this is what humans in the 21st century looked like and lived like. And, you know, some people say that's very exploitive and, you know, it depends on how they source these things. And obviously families can't consent to this kind of thing when they're 1500, 2000 years old.
Right.
But if, as long as I think it's handled with the proper educational tone, because to look at these things, we learned so much about human civilizations and how they lived in prior, you know, ages and eras, and you can get a lot out of it. But yeah, you have to be very respectful of it at the same time.
And one notable thing about the Haraldsgaard woman is that there was a longstanding rumor or speculation that she was the 10th century Viking queen Gunnhild. Who was drowned by her husband, Harald Bluetooth. I love that his last name is Bluetooth. But
wow.
Yeah. But apparently it's untrue because through radiocarbon dating, they've noted that Haraldsgaard woman is about 2,200 years old. So
well
predates 1835 when Queen Gunnhild was drowned by her husband. There's also the Grauball man. He was discovered in 1952, and his pose is almost yoga-like in this lounging position. His feet and skin are almost entirely intact. As well as hair. And the hair is often turned like a red color. There's a chemical process called the Maillard reaction. And so when you see these bog bodies, they have just really strong kind of dark red hair.
I have to do another side one there because this is now the first time I have ever heard the term Maillard reaction used outside of a context involving cooking.
Did I say that word correctly, by the way?
You absolutely did.
Okay, good.
And, but the Maillard reaction, they always say, you know, when you brown like a steak on the grill, you get that, the browning, like that crust, that sort of the stuff that when you sear meat, it makes it taste good.
Yeah.
Or those little bits that stick to the bottom. It's all a result of the Maillard reaction.
Yeah, very interesting. And so another thing about the Grauball man is it appears that he was forced on his knees and his throat was slashed ear to ear from someone standing behind him. But also appears that he was deposited with care into the bog. So it's one of these things where, again, the thought is, well, is this a sacrifice where it's a quick end to your life, but we're still, you know, we're not going to just deposit a body in a very careless fashion. And so perhaps this underlies some important aspect of cultural life in the period. We just don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the Tolland man and similarly the Elling woman. So the Tolland man is remarkably undamaged. His body was also discovered in the 1950s. And in fact, it was so well preserved that authorities thought it might be a boy who had been reported missing around that time. So that's how much there's not been decay in these bodies. And it appears he's about 2,400 years old.
That's incredible. Just to know that the chemical atmosphere and the chemical environment, you have a very highly anaerobic environment in that, in those bogs, there's no oxygen down in there.
Right.
And then you have the acidity or the pH level caused by all that decaying matter of plant matter. And so it just does result in something like this. And it's absolutely fascinating to know that they're coming out of these bogs so well intact that they look like they've a recently alive person. It's really hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, because you have those layers of moss that accumulate, and they kind of, it was described as forming a dome fed entirely by rainwater. As you mentioned, there's few minerals, there's little oxygen, there's lots of acid, and then you add in lower temperatures in Northern Europe, and effectively you have a refrigerator for preserving or conserving a human body.
That's incredible.
And the decomposition is so slow. And, you know, the acids also are what tan the skin, hair, and nails. So that's part of what gives that, again, what I'm calling kind of a bronze look. And
the Jersey Shore look.
Right. And as the moss dies, it releases carbohydrate polymer. That's the sphagnin. And it apparently binds nitrogen, which halts the growth of bacteria, further mummifying the corpse. The sphagnin also extracts calcium, which leaches out the body's bones. So this explains why, after thousands of years or so, the corpses kind of look like this squished rubber doll. And again, you have that look on them. But nevertheless, their facial features are so well preserved. And Tolland Man has like full, perfectly intact lips. It's almost curled into this mysterious semi-smile. His face is very striking, like it almost looks like somebody took a plaster mold of it and then sculpted, you know, something in with stone or metal.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of like an obsidian look to him. And weren't they able to find out what these people ate or something too? Didn't they go in?
Yeah, so actually they can look at the contents of their stomach. And I'll talk about that in a second. But there's some speculation as to some of these people dying in the winter based on what's in their stomach. That would be more of a winter diet of food that you would eat. That would be what was in season at that time. Which does lead to some of that speculation that these were sacrifices for spring harvest, that you would have a better spring if somebody, you know, gave themselves to the gods for, you know, fertile crop that year.
Right, right. Well, it's one less mouth to feed at any rate.
Right. And so the Ellen woman, which I mentioned, she's found about 40 meters from Tolland Man and is thought to have died around the same time. And she has hair that is about 90 centimeters in these long, elaborate braids and knots. And we'll come back to her hair in a second, because that could perhaps hold some clues to this mystery. So I do want to come back to something you mentioned, because there's a big aspect about restoring the humanity and the fact that we call them bog bodies rather than people. Mm-hmm. And so in 1965, Peter Wilhelm Glob, he is a professor of archaeology at the University of Aarhus, and I apologize for all those pronunciations, and he wrote a book, The Bog People, and his goal was really to create an understanding, restore the humanity, that these were people. As you mentioned, they were living their lives, they were living in a society, they were doing what they thought was necessary to live and survive, and somehow met these what appeared to be very graphic ends. And in Glob's view, the Tolland Man and some of those others were sacrificed to Nerthus, the Earth Mother, to ensure a good crop, as I just mentioned. And we know this because of the contents of their stomachs. What was interesting with the Tolland Man is we know he was hanged, but from the mark, it's higher up on his throat. And if he had been strangled, it would have been lower down, apparently. So the thinking is maybe that that wasn't what actually killed him. Again, perhaps suggesting a ritual sacrifice. So that was kind of interesting. Also, while there's a lot of preservation that does take place, what doesn't really get preserved well is DNA. That's been the challenge to doing some modern testing on some of these bog people to see, you know, can we get some sort of profile and learn more about where they're from, where they did they travel? Are they native to Denmark? Are they from other parts of Europe? Or
well, sure. It's like what they've done with like Neanderthal DNA. If you get one of those 23andMe tests, they'll tell you how much of your DNA is related to Neanderthal DNA. And it'd be amazing if they could extract some of that, that people could sequence it and see if they're related to
right.
any of these people. That'd be incredible.
Yeah. And who knows what another decade or so, you know, might be able to produce. But there's a little bit of hope here. So again, the decent sample of DNA, hard to come by, mostly because the acid that we talked about in those bogs tend to cause DNA to disintegrate. Mm-hmm. So really, the hope is extracting DNA from the teeth or the petrous bone, because they're very dense and their density protects the DNA.
Yeah, I've heard of them extracting DNA from tooth pulp in a number of cases.
Yeah, and so the Haraldsgaard woman, they did do an extraction from her tooth. There's no way to certify that the human DNA was contaminated or not. So, you know, it's still a little bit of a mystery there, but some of the answers may come from strontium.
Oh, so, the element. Yeah.
So strontium is preserved nearly everywhere in nature in proportions that vary from one place to another. And people and animals absorb strontium through eating and drinking. And based on, again, those proportions or ratios, particularly the isotopes of strontium 87 and 86, we can get a pretty good map of different countries. And thereby, we can sort of create a map of where this person came from and traveled over time.
Amazing.
Which is just absolutely wild. And so the molar enamel is a great place to look, as well as the long bone and the leg. The long bone and the leg, this is fascinating, will show where you spent the last 10 years of your life.
What?
So,
whoa.
Which is crazy.
That is crazy. It's like looking at tree rings or something.
And the rib will localize where you were in the last 3 to 4 years. And I didn't say this earlier. A molar will show where you came from originally. So basically, if you have those aspects, you could learn where people were at different parts of their life.
Oh, wild. Wow. That's incredible. I think that's why I want to be going to science. They need to figure that out.
Absolutely. But again, here's the issue. Bog bodies, bog people, most of them don't have bones. And their teeth are terribly degraded. So despite the preservation, these are not areas. But one of the scientists, the researchers, was like, what about gathering strontium from human hair?
Aha, yes.
Well, we have a couple of these women who are preserved that have very long hair. So the Haraldsgaard woman, in 2012, her hair was looked at as almost 50 centimeters long. And what the researcher realized is like, hey, we can investigate rapid mobility because it works as kind of a fast-growing archive, your hair, right? So your hair is growing, and so, you know, it almost gives us a timeline, if you will.
Oh, yeah. It's like when if you've been poisoned, they can pull out some of your hair and find out when you started being poisoned as to where it appears on the shaft of the hair.
So amazing. So amazing. So from the Haraldsgaard woman, they were able to extract a small amount of enamel from her tooth and realized that she was raised locally. But the tip of her hair told us that in the months before her death, she went quite far, indicating that she traveled to a volcanic area. They surmise maybe Germany or the UK. They did a similar analysis of another woman, and they found similar results. So in both of these cases, the women had traveled just before they died. And the research was like, it made me think if they were sacrificed, maybe the trip was part of that sacrifice. So that's really causing them to rethink everything. So that's kind of what we have at this point. But strontium is like giving us some really interesting clues as to how these people traveled, moved around. And maybe that's just one more little piece to help solve this mystery.
That's so freaking cool. It really is. And I'm laughing. I've been laughing to myself quietly since you started talking about this case, Chris, because
is this your book?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's my case in my country. Now, I don't know if we're ready to move on to that yet, but it's kind of a segue. It's serving as a segue because my case in Sweden is quite similar to this one.
Okay, so there is a little bit of overlap maybe, or just
there's
like
a little. Okay. It's not actual overlap,
okay,
but it is very much a similar thing, type of thing.
Well, let's not delay. I think we need to get to our eighth country. What do we have in store? I'm ready. Well, I'm ready to shut up and listen a little bit. I feel like I've been talking nonstop. I am ready to hear a story.
Well, we are going to travel, friends, not far from Denmark, because we are still hanging out in Scandinavia. We're heading to the world of IKEA, Sweden.
Can I just say right now, big shout to our friends in the Scandinavian countries. What a great representation. In this. I love that they're all clustered together here in this trio of listenership. Very exciting.
Absolutely. I don't know where Finland is right now in any of this, but I know there are some Finnish listeners out there that just maybe didn't quite crack the top 10. But yes, in Sweden, I had a big choice of cases.
Okay.
Let's be honest. Because I think the lore that comes out of Sweden in particular, I always feel like it's the most famous of the Nordic countries. You know, Norway's up there, yes, but people mostly think of Sweden. Again, I think because the culture is sort of assimilated a little more into our country. So
sure.
I mentioned IKEA already, but even something like IHOP and Lingonberry pancakes and, mm-hmm. you know, just stuff like
Saab,
that.
Volvo, so,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Swedish meatballs and, you know, all those lovely things.
Well, and was it the girl on the train? Or Dragon Tattoo. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
I was going to mention that. Yeah. One of the most famous now, you know, just my opinion, probably one of the most boring books I ever tried to read in my life.
Oh, boy.
But the movies were fine. But the book
Sweet,
was...
Sweden might be coming after you, man.
Ooh, come for me. I'm not going to blame the Swedes on this, but I will blame whoever translated Stieg Larsson's book.
There we go. There it is.
But,
wait, where are the Skarsgårds from?
They are Swedish, and they're going to come for me. Come on, come for me, Alexander. I am ready. Come for me, Bill. I am ready. That whole clan can come
my
for me.
My body is ready. Totally okay.
but we are not anywhere near coming into the modern age here. We're going to remain in the Iron Age.
Oh.
But we're going to jump forward another 500 years.
Okay.
About 1,500 years ago.
Okay.
Where a crime scene was discovered on an island just off the coast of Sweden called Sandby Borg.
Mm.
A lot of archaeologists are kind of scouring a lot of these islands, have been for many, many years. And in 2010, they started excavating this particular island and they discovered numerous pits that were filled with jewelry and other valuable items. Well, then they came back a few years later.
I'm getting some Oak Island vibes, by the way.
Yeah. they came back a few years later and kept digging, and then they started finding human remains.
Oh.
Which, you know, I mean, there were people living there. However, the positioning of the corpses and the forensic evidence that they found all pointed to that at some point in the late 5th century, an act of mass murder occurred where victims that included children were caught by surprise, murdered, and left where they fell. And the team has been trying to reconstruct what happened at this crime scene ever since.
Wow.
You know, so a lot of what you were mentioning with the state of the bodies, the overkill, the brutality of some of these murders, very much echoes what happened here.
Now, how preserved are these remains?
Not as well preserved as the bog.
Because they're in a pit,
people.
Right? They're not in bogs. They're in pits.
Right.
Okay.
Or they're just like they were buried over time, you know, but they've still been very well preserved, but nothing like where you would have skin intact and things like that.
Okay.
And I want to correct what I said earlier. I said Sandby Borg. That is the actual name of the fort that was on the island. Mm. The name of the island is Erland. It's an O with an umlaut L-A-N-D. I think I pronounced that correct.
Okay.
Just going off my very bad German training. But it lies off of Sweden's eastern coast, about 250 miles south of the capital of Stockholm. And it is covered with alder forests, grassland, and beaches, of course, that are just regularly battered by the Baltic Sea, just to give you this idea of the environment we're working with here. And there are a lot of Iron Age era ring forts, that they call them, that are all over this island. And most of them are only about a couple acres each. So they almost were just like little settlements that were along this island. And they're all been enclosed by the walls, essentially.
Okay.
And you can still see a lot of the outlines of these walls and these structures even today. But the wall isn't up, but they estimate that the wall that went around this fort was about 16 feet high. And there were about 53 dwellings inside that wall. And the people that lived in there, they had a lot of things to protect, because there were all kinds of treasures buried on this island. This thing was chock full of rings, brooches, bells, coins. There again, Roman coins. And the Erlen warriors worked as mercenaries, imperial mercenaries, that were employed by the Roman Empire. And so those elites, probably they think that they did a lot of trading with Rome, and that's how they kind of got so rich. Then that's where they got a lot of those luxury goods that they found on the island.
Is the thought that this is like a vault of like, this is our bank vault of where we're keeping the loot?
Very possible. Very possible. Okay. We'll get to that in a bit, because I'm still not entirely clear as to, and I don't think they're entirely clear as to where all this treasure came from.
Okay.
And there's pictures of it, of a lot of this treasure, gorgeous things, like, wow.
Yeah, I kind of think like fort, it's protected, it's on an island. And you're going to, you know, this is where we're going to kind of preserve whatever.
It's almost like a bank, like an early bank.
Exactly. You know? Or it's like it's like that, their Fort Knox, right? Of where we're going to have the stronghold of all of our, you know, precious reserves.
So yeah, was like a heist or something? And they obviously didn't get everything.
Yeah. But, okay.
In 2011, they found the first human remains at Sandby Borg, and they uncovered 2 feet and later matched 2 feet, as in foots.
Oh, okay.
Foot, plural.
Okay.
I said foots. Yeah, that's where my brain is tonight.
The feetses.
Screw grammar.
Yeah,
feetses. And they were able to match them with a skeleton of a late teenage-aged male whose skull had been split open. And in the course of several other digs, they found that Sandby Borg yielded even more grim finds. Mm. They found that despite only excavating 3 out of the 53 dwellings in the settlement, the remains of 26 individuals have been found in those houses and in street areas, all bearing signs of ferocious violence.
Mm.
And the fate of one man whose body lies just inside a dwelling has been pieced together, and they found that he was likely first wounded in the street and then stumbled into the house looking for safety, at which point he was pursued, caught, and beaten in the head. They were able to kind of figure out the movement.
That is so fascinating to me that they could somehow piece that together. Like that it's an action scene, basically, of like, this happened, then this.
It almost makes you wonder if he was like stretched out on the ground, like he looked like he'd been crawling toward, and then somebody just felled him, you know, kind of half inside, half outside the door or something like that, or right inside the door. Like he looked, you know.
Yeah, like how much of this is just speculation and how much of it is actually like, well, we have evidence of this because we see a footprint here to here and we've measured the leg, so we know that they were not moving at a slow pace. Like it's all that kind of stuff where I'm like, it's so fascinating.
It really is. It really is. And one building known as House 40, they found 9 bodies, including those of 2 very young children. Inside the house, they found a decapitated body of a teenage boy. While in House 52, archaeologists uncovered the remains of an elderly man that were lying over the hearth of the house. His bones suggest he was beaten violently, and of course, charring around his pelvic area indicates he was either wounded or already dead when he fell into the fire. So he stumbles into his house, badly, gravely injured, and literally just falls on the hearth into his, you know, because in these areas, and in most areas even today, these very rural areas, if you go to somewhere like Tibet, for instance, they always have a fire burning right in the middle of the house. And that's where they do all their cooking and that's where they get all their heat. In 2023, that's happening. So that's what they were doing back then. And they noticed that the bodies had not been buried or treated with any actual funeral rites. Instead, they must have just lain in the exact same positions where they had been struck down more than 1,500 years ago. And here's another thing, too, about the 26 victims at the site, including the children and the adults. They're all male.
Okay.
Yeah. The presence of female items in the treasure pits, however, suggests women did live at the community, but they couldn't find out where the women went.
Wait, so every single body is male. Mm-hmm. Wow. Which almost makes you wonder, were they under attack? And well, I was going to say, you know, women and children first, let's get them to safety. But there are, you said children there, right?
Yes, but there were children.
Children, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
And you know, some people hypothesize that you know, the women could have been carried off by the attackers or they could have just fled the village. Whoever did this was obviously very intent on killing all the men
That's
or
a good
boys.
Point. Yeah.
And, and you know, that could be for any number of reasons that they took the women for, you know, bargaining or sexual purposes or just to use as slaves. I don't know why they wouldn't take the men to use this, you know, because men are often valuable for that as well. But there's no evidence at all to suggest there was any type of military engagement. This is a very domestic setting.
Okay.
And they've looked at the defensive wounds of the victims that all suggest that this overwhelming attack just took place all at the same time.
Wow.
Like it was a coordinated thing. And doing more forensic analysis, they found that the blows came from blunt instruments and a sharp weapon, such as a sword, rained down on the victims from above and behind. A lack of evidence of trauma to forearms suggests that the victims did not have time to defend themselves, nor have any shields or weapons ever been found near any of the victims at all. So you figure if it was a military attack, they would have seen it coming. You know, if you're watching an island, you're guarding an island, you're going to see boats come in, right? So it would almost suggest that the call came from inside the house. You know what I'm saying? That there might have been, you know, a sort of a skirmish that happened within the settlement itself.
Yeah, like was there a dispute amongst the, you know, the people who were there kind of a thing? No, that's so fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is that the intact treasure stashes are still very puzzling because why were they left? Why didn't they take that? One theory is that the massacre was so brutal that everyone, including the women, was either dead or too scared to return. So maybe they took some loot and left, maybe with the intent to come back, and they just didn't or couldn't for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And scholars also wondered why the murderers did not loot the wealthy village and why later treasure hunters left the site untouched for centuries after the destruction. So people came to this island, found this treasure, did not take it. Why?
Is there no like folklore or anything about a curse or a, you know, I'm trying to think out loud, like what would cause that to happen? Because you said the first body was found in 2011. That's very, very recent.
It is.
Wow.
It really, really is. And, you know, the most recent articles I found on this, like this National Geographic article that I'll post in the show notes that I got most of this information from, and there are a few other great sources too. You know, they talk about how they're still excavating to this day or still investigating to this day. I think the most recent one was like 2021,
okay,
I think, is when this National Geographic article was released. Archaeologists believe that they have some answers, though, which include including events that led up to the attack. So the fortress's retaining wall was built around 400 AD, around the time that Rome's power was starting to decline.
Okay.
And as the community had grown wealthy from Roman contact, it would have felt the economic impact of the Western Roman Empire's recession. And so as Rome provided fewer goods and jobs to the island, social structures started to shift. And after the Western Roman Empire fell in 476, and, you know, so yeah, it was right. We're talking a quarter of a century later, Rome is done. So we're right at the end here.
Yeah.
Did I say a quarter, three quarters of a century? Math is hard. and after the empire fell in 476, uncertainty just kind of like spread across the old Roman Empire. And so these years are known as the migration period, where they saw strife between neighboring people, essentially. So things start falling apart. We don't know who's in charge. You know, imagine being a member of an empire that spans from we're on an island in the middle of Sweden all the way over to Italy.
Right.
And beyond, you know, so the Roman Empire being as massive as it is and your leader, you know, you got a Caesar somewhere thousands of miles away. And that now that's gone. What now? And so the people that have been examining all this evidence, one lady named Clara Alfsdotter at Linnaeus University in Kalmar, Sweden, she's been one of the forefront people studying this. And she says that the perpetrators do not appear to have been very interested in staying or searching for loot. Alfsdotter observes, she suggests their motivation was likely revenge based on a feeling of past injustice and a perception of the Sandby-Borg group as a threat. Hmm. And ultimately, the motive behind the massacre was probably to attain regional power and control. So one clan versus another, we're getting a lot of tribalism kind of coming back to the fore here. And the attackers did extinguish all life there, and the settlement ceased there that day. No one disposed of the bodies, which may have caused Sandby-Borg to develop a reputation as a cursed place that kept treasure hunters away. And because it's still mostly untouched, aside from these archaeologists, it's become this huge boon because it's this perfectly preserved look at Iron Age violence, essentially.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, not very far from Denmark and the Bog people that all died from questionable circumstance. The nature of this one, though, definitely stuck with me a little bit. I keep thinking about this island. And in the National Geographic article, they'll show pictures of the pendants and some of the other things that they found, this very ornate, beautiful gold and silver and all these metals that have been, you know, forged and made into beautiful things. And it's amazing to think that the people of the time knew that heard about the Sandby-Borg fort, and yeah, they spread the folklore that this is cursed, don't touch this island. And to this day, again, still very untouched. I would love to learn more about the archaeologists that have worked on there and what else they've felt or found, and because it's very haunting to even think what went down that day and how and who threw the first punch or, you know, swung the first sword, you know.
Yeah, this whole idea of effectively an entire community vanishing, and in this case being, you know, killed, murdered in some, you know, pretty brutal fashion. I'm getting, it's a different story, but I'm getting echoes of like the Lost Roanoke colony.
I was just thinking about that too.
Yeah. Here in the States. And it's like that same idea is like a entire community kind of vanishes, but also it feels like people were going about their normal day. And then like everyone just got up, walked away, and were never seen again.
Yes.
Different circumstances again, but it has that kind of echo, which is just like, what the heck would cause this? And
yeah,
if it was something that was understandable, why don't we know it? Why can't we ascertain it? If we know somebody ran, did a jump, did a pivot, and died here from a, like, how can we not figure out the bigger part of this mystery? Like who, what?
Yeah.
Oh man. Like this kind of stuff is just so amazing that it endures as a mystery with all of these tricks and, you know, forensic evaluation and archaeological know-how, that it's still just a freaking head
scratcher.
And then you
have all these people of this historical, like they've studied history and they just understand these cultures, these very specific microcultures within, like a culture within a culture. And the people that have specialized in this, they probably number only a handful of people in the whole world that know enough to be able to investigate this properly,
right,
and makes you thankful for the people that went to school for this kind of stuff that really made this their specialty, because we wouldn't know anything about it. That's why, you know, if somebody says, yes, I'm going to college for history or archaeology, and they're like, well, you're not going to do a damn thing with your life. And it's like, not so fast there, buddy. These are very valuable things that people are doing. And again, to know, too, you have this sort of touchstone. We're living in a period where mass murder is still quite commonplace for various reasons and various motivations. And then you look and see that back 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, we weren't so different. You know, just the weapons have changed and the motivations have changed. Maybe.
Yeah.
So, that's Sweden. And, you know, I think at least for this episode, I might be wrong. I'm going to head back to my notes real quick. But I think that this might be the last of the Scandinavian countries that we have for this episode. We are venturing now to the Emerald Isle.
Oh,
to lovely Ireland.
Speaking of Pete,
a place that I have always wanted to go, hope to one day.
Gorgeous,
and I know you've been there.
Country.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough to travel to several parts of the Republic of Ireland. I did not get up into Northern Ireland. I would go back in a heartbeat.
Excellent.
Without question, I would go back. Fantastic.
A friend of mine is in there. She just got home from there. Probably within the last couple of days, her pictures were just amazing.
Oh.
They went to the Cliffs of Moher.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Just so beautiful.
Yeah.
This case not only takes place there, but it is a good bit more modern, and it's just a little odd. It does involve a man. It does involve a dead man named Peter Bergman.
Okay.
He is known by many who have studied this case as the man who never existed. And there have been a few cases like this that we may even talk about on this show, where somebody is found dead and they have no idea who he is. And, you know, most of the pictures that you find of this person are of him dead, because that's literally all they have. And they found him dead in Sligo County, or in Sligo, which more like the northwestern bit of Ireland. And on or around June 16th of 2009 is when they found him. But the man, using the alias Peter Bergman, checked into the Sligo City Hotel on June 12th, where he stayed during the majority of his visit. And many of his movements were caught on CCTV throughout the town, because by this point, of course, in the 2000s, most of these cities in Europe and elsewhere are very, very heavily surveilled.
Right.
And heck, even in this country, you know, that's happening more and more. And we're doing it all ourselves with our little doorbells and what have you.
Right.
And the detail of his actions and intentions remains unknown to this day. And his interactions with other people were limited. And little is known of his origins or his reasons for visiting there. But on the morning of June 16th, the body of the unidentified man was discovered at Ross's Point Beach, which is a popular destination in the area for mostly fishing and other types of activity. And even though they conducted a 5-month investigation into his death, the Gardaí, which I think is the name of basically Ireland's FBI or state police,
okay,
or, you know, sort of thing, they have never been able to identify the man or develop any leads. And I know this sounds like it's going nowhere, right? I mostly want to talk about what they do know leading up to his death. And whenever you search this man, you will find a picture of him. And maybe if you recognize something about it, make contact with the proper authorities. The case was actually the subject of a 2013 documentary called The Last Days of Peter Bergman, which was shown at the Sundance Film Festival. And there's a good following on it as well. I've seen people on Reddit talk about this. I have not watched it. I just did not have the time as I was getting my prep together, but that is the documentary if you want to look further into this. But here's what they do know. On Friday, June 12th, the man we know as Peter Bergman was spotted at the Ulster Bus Depot in Derry between about 2:30 and 4 o'clock local time. And he boarded a bus that headed back to Sligo, carrying a black shoulder bag and a standard carry-on luggage bag. So he arrives, he's got his luggage. Checked in at 8:28 at the bus station, took a taxi to the Sligo City Hotel, where he paid per night in cash. And while he checked in, he gave a false name of Peter Bergman and an address that was later reported as one in Vienna, Austria. And he had a slender build, stood about 5'10" or 1.79 meters. I'm just going to try to use as many European measurements as I can, given what the countries we're talking about. But he had short gray hair, blue eyes, a tan complexion, and appeared to be in his late 50s or early 60s. And the staff at the hotel, they claim the man was of Germanic descent and spoke English with a very thick German accent. Mm. Look at us. All these countries related to Germany.
Yeah.
And Chris, you and I have taken German. You know, we took German in high school. We've talked about that on the show before. And I'm just feeling all these like German things. It all goes back to Germany.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And so he was very neatly groomed. His face was fresh shaven. His hair was nicely combed. He was wearing a black leather jacket, blue trousers, socks, black leather belt, and a pair of black shoes. He was cleaned up. He was looking good. And his clothes were from a very popular fashion retail store in Europe, with most of its stores in Germany and Austria. So again, it's very clear this guy is probably of German or Germanic descent. And from his appearance, it was assumed he was just some kind of professional of some kind, but he was a frequent smoker. And so most of the surveillance videos actually show him standing outside smoking. Mm. And during his stay at the hotel, he was seen on CCTV leaving with a purple plastic bag full of items or personal effects. And when he returned from his long walk, he was no longer carrying that bag. It is presumed that he had disposed of his belongings throughout Sligo and then folded the bag and put it in his pocket. Authorities were not able to identify what he threw away in the public rubbish bins, as the man used the blind spots of the surveillance cameras to his advantage. So he knew.
Interesting.
He was being watched.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And his movements were very meticulous and very methodical. It's like he knew that where to hide his personal belongings and stuff, like he knew where to hide them or they wouldn't be found. Like he knew what he was doing. On the 13th of June, they saw him walking to the Sligo post office at around 11 a.m. And he purchased 8 82-cent stamps and airmail stickers. And the following day, he left the hotel between 11 and 11:30 and asked the taxi driver for recommendations for a nice quiet beach where he could swim. And the taxi driver stated that Ross's Point would be the best place and proceeded to drive the man to the beach. And the man returned with the same taxi and was dropped off at the bus station in Sligo. So this is him probably scouting locations at this point. Now we are going to jump to where they found his body. So on Monday, June 15th, the man checked out of the hotel at 1 o'clock or a little after 1 o'clock and handed in his room key. He left with a black shoulder bag, a purple plastic bag, probably that same one, and that he was using the day before, and a different black luggage bag. He did not have the same black carry-on luggage bag he had when he arrived. So what the hell happened there?
Interesting.
He walked to the bus station, stopped at a shopping center, and waited in the doorway of a shop for a number of minutes. They didn't really explain why, but they're just noting all the areas that they saw him, and he looked like he was kind of standing awkwardly in that area for some reason. And he went
like
to a coffee shop.
Like he's waiting for something?
Yeah.
Or someone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Possibly. At a coffee shop around 2:30, he orders a cappuccino, toasted ham and cheese sandwich at the bus station. While eating his food, he looked at pieces of paper that he kept in his pocket. This is interesting right here.
Okay.
After reading the pieces of paper, he tore the paper in half and threw it away in a nearby trash can. And then he then mounted a bus at not long after that for Ross's Point. And it was reported that he was seen by 16 different people walking on the beach, casually greeting passersby. So the following morning, a man named Arthur Kinsella and his son Brian, who was training for a triathlon, found the man's body lying on the beach at 6:45 in the morning. He was wearing purple striped Speedo type swimming trunks with his underpants over the top and a navy t-shirt tucked into them.
Hmm. Okay.
Envision. Why? What?
Interesting.
Arthur and Brian said the Lord's Prayer for the man and then called the Gardaí, the cops. At 8:10, Dr. Valerie McGowan officially pronounced the man dead and a 5-month investigation began. So why was he dressed that way? I don't know. And
so he has a swimsuit, underpants over that. Are these like boxers? Do you know?
That's a very good point.
The only reason I ask is, like, is he wearing them as just like shorts to kind of, you know, cover up wearing a Speedo? Or,
well,
because if they're briefs, then that's a really,
so he was wearing, yeah, purple striped Speedo type swimming trunks. See, when we see Speedo, it's like, Speedo is a brand name, so they make all kinds of swimwear. So when they say Speedo type, a lot of people think when they think Speedo, though, they think of the little banana hammock. They're not thinking like the things that the Olympic swimmers wear, not swim trunks.
Yeah, and they're not always.
They could be trunks.
They're not always that small. They could like go down mid thigh, but they're still that skin tight, whatever it is, Lycra, Spandex,
that's
whatever.
That's very true.
So you're okay. All right. Regardless.
So maybe they were trunks with the underpants over. So maybe he had briefs. Put on over the trunks,
okay.
But the navy t-shirt tucked in to the trunks. Like maybe he was doing like a makeshift wetsuit, but why double up on the bottoms?
Yeah, that's an odd detail for sure. Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so according to the autopsy, the body of the man found on Ross's Point Beach with most of his clothes left behind on the shore with no wallet, money, or form of identification. Even though the man had been washed up on the beach, the medical examiner found no evidence of saltwater drowning.
Okay.
But also found no signs of foul play that would give reason to believe that the death was a homicide. Okay.
Hmm.
See, I'm left wondering, like, what lies in between? If it was natural causes, but if he didn't drown, then how else did he die? The man's teeth were in good condition, showed signs of frequent dental work in his life. He had bridging, root canals, crowns, had a full gold tooth on the upper back right side of his mouth, and fillings along the gum. So he had a gold tooth. And he was well-groomed, but despite all that, he was actually in poor health. The postmortem showed he had advanced stages of prostate cancer and bone tumors. And his heart showed signs of previous heart disease. And so for a man who had all these health conditions, however, the toxicology report said he had no medication at all in his system.
Hmm.
And the medical examiner also noted that due to the man's health status, he would have been in significant pain and would have required prescription pain medicine or at least over-the-counter pain relievers. When you have bone cancer,
yeah.
I imagine that is agonizing.
Right.
But after 5 months of investigating, they buried his body there. And what's really sad is only 4 police officers attended. And some sources say that the police investigation that followed his death, it was discovered that the address he gave at the hotel belonged to a vacant lot. And others have pointed out that a street with the reported spelling of Einstetterson, doing the best I can with that one, does not exist in Austria or Germany. Hmm. And additionally, Vienna postcodes begin with the number 1 rather than the number 4. And the postcode 4472 was unassigned. So this was a completely fake. He just made this shit up, it sounds like.
Right.
But it's unclear how the police would have been able to figure out how they figured out that it was tied to a vacant lot or whether they just determined that it didn't exist. And maybe that was just a figure of speech. It's nothing. It's a vacant lot. It's nothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what they do know is that the man definitely wanted to remain unknown and he very much planned his move so he couldn't be identified. And then in 2015, French newspaper Le Monde reported that they had contacted Austrian police about the case and that Austrian police commented that the Gardaí had never contacted them. And LeMond also reported that there is no Interpol notice for the unidentified man because the body did not fall into either of the two Interpol categories for missing or wanted person. Mm. It is the responsibility of the man's country of origin to report him as missing. So he probably knew that, too. It's probably why he traveled all the way to Ireland to do this. As of December 2022, the man is still unidentified. No relatives, friends, or witnesses have come forward, despite public appeals in Austrian and German newspapers. Although the Gardaí retain the man's DNA, a spokesperson said the DNA analysis could only narrow down the area the man might have been from, but not identify him. So he's just in the wind at this point. Here's a man who rolls into this town of all towns. They couldn't really find out why he picked this place. But you have to know who the person is to know that.
Right.
But to so methodically erase yourself from the world, and he's terminally ill. So I think that was a big part of his motivation. But it does make you wonder why he didn't want to be identified. This is just a choice he made, but we don't know who he is.
Yeah, you do have to wonder if it was like maybe he doesn't really have family. You're not going to be reported missing if you don't really have people. And to your point, maybe this place held some kind of significance to him.
Yeah.
And if he didn't have any medication, it could be like, well, I'm at the end of life. I just want to go out on my own terms. I don't want to be on this medication. I don't want to suffer, you know, XYZ side effects.
Right.
And I'm going to go to this beach that had some significance to me that only I would really know, or, you know, who knows? Like, your mind wants to go spy. This
right.
was a spy.
Right.
There's no identity. I mean, if there is some indication as to that being a potential thing, sure. Like, most people don't go to the extremes of, like, having this completely untraceable identity. But, you know, if there's something where he wanted to do it on his own terms and for whatever reason did not want to be identified, but just wanted to go quietly into the night, if you will.
It's almost like he was someone who didn't want to burden anybody with his end of life care.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, although I do think that if he had family that he could have burdened with that they would have reported him missing. And so it could also then be that he was alone. He realized he didn't have any next of kin or anybody who could help him. And so this is sort of the next, you know, phase, and he knew he was ready to go.
Right.
I mean, I think that's probably the best explanation as to why he did what he did. The mystery being, of course, who is this man?
Sure.
But there are so, you know, for as connected as we all are across the world through these mediums, it's a reminder of how anonymous so many people are on this planet. You know, 7 billion, 8 billion people. How many people like this Peter Bergman guy are out there? They've been able to identify some of these people, but there are a lot of cases like this one. And one great place to look for the, like, these sort of missing persons type cases is to go over to the Charlie Project. It's one of the best sites out there that is run by one person, and she just does such a great job and relies on donations. But she just categorizes so many missing people from all over the world, and I think he's on there as well. So, you know, if you're ever interested in helping solve something like this, that's a really good place to start. Is to go over to the Charlie Project and see what you can find. You never know what you might run across or who.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that, my friend, takes us out of Ireland. And we're on to the last country of this episode. And that's back to you, my friend.
Back to me to wrap up part one with our sixth country. Another place I've been to. Got a little double feature here. South Africa.
Excellent.
So
I was so excited when this country popped up. By the way, this is South Africa has a very fascinating country with a history that is, it's just full of history, interesting history that I think a lot of people don't know. And I certainly am not that educated in it myself. It's just not covered as much, but, so I am very excited to see what you pulled out of here.
Well, you know, I was all prepared to talk about this like lost treasure the Kruger Millions. These were these Krugerrands. This was a currency that at that time, the South African Republic then president, Paul Kruger, had to basically flee the country because of invasion. And all of these coins, these millions of Krugerrands, were effectively smuggled out, you know, taken out so that he could go solidify some kind of army and try to, you know, win the Boer War. And this money disappears and no one knows where it is. And I was like, oh, this could be an interesting mystery, like this lost hoard of coins. Well, they were found.
Okay.
I could not tell if they were all found or if some of them were found.
Okay.
Kruger, I call them Krugerrands. I think they're called Kruger Ponds as well. But basically, they were discovered in a Swiss vault and are now for sale. So they're not only found, you can actually purchase some of them. So
are they worth anything?
I think the numismatic scholars and community are very excited about it. So yes, I think they are.
Very cool.
Even if each individual one is not worth a particularly large amount, there's a very fascinating,
historical significance.
Exactly, yeah. The history of it is pretty fascinating. So that mystery dried up, but I'm kind of glad it did, because I found a delightful little tale, and I think it's a more interesting, fun way to wrap up. There's been some heavy topics in this episode.
Very much. A lot of mass murder.
Yeah.
Sad, solitary man dying that we don't know who he is.
So I think it's only fitting that we talk about the Statlerville monster.
Ooh, is this kind of like a cryptid kind of situation?
Ma'am, you hit the nail on the head.
Nailed
you
it.
You hit the Krugerrand on the head. So let's talk a little bit about Statlerville first. So Statlerville is located in kind of south central region of the country. It's southwest of Lesotho, which I love this fact, so I wanted to bring it up. It's one of only three countries that's completely surrounded by another country or internal waters. So there's only three countries out of, 196 or however many there are? There's so many. So
wow.
You had the Kingdom of Lesotho, completely enclaved within South Africa. You have the Republic of San Marino, which is enclaved within Italy. And then you have Vatican City, which is actually enclaved within the city of Rome, also in Italy.
Right.
So So the Vatican City is the only one to be completely surrounded, not by a country, but a city. Very interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Is the Vatican City recognized as a country or a city? It's a city within the city. I don't know, man. Geopolitical
country
stuff
or a
is
nation?
Just,
like, I believe it's a nation unto itself, right? Like,
I see. I wasn't sure. Yeah, if it was recognized as a nation,
maybe not a country per se or nation. Like, country versus nation. I'm very. I know there's an important nuance and distinction I can't quite make.
It's a little like Washington D.C. is not
correct.
A city per se.
Right.
It's a weird little neutral thing.
It's a district.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway, that was a little side tangent. But so Statlerville, like I said, the kind of south central region of the country. And it's described as one of the quaintest Karoo towns in South Africa, a sleepy little town on the Eastern Cape. It's home to architectural gems. It's popular amongst artists and retirees. It's surrounded by a broad expanse of endless plains, flat-topped kopjes, and beautiful mountains.
Nice.
It's described as an arid paradise dotted with succulents and plum trees, and a theater for stargazing and awe-inspiring sunrises and sunsets due to clear skies and lack of light pollution.
Sounds perfect.
Sounds like a lovely little place. Well, perhaps not in 2011, because something sinister appeared in this quaint little town, with headlines such as "Shapeshifting Monster Terrorizes South African Town," "The Shapeshifter in the Karoo," and my favorite blog title, "Man Bat Pig."
It's real, okay?
Just like Man Bear Pig.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Indeed, yeah. Oh, I love that.
So May of 2011, reports start coming out of Statlerville, this small town, about a shape-shifting monster terrorizing residents. And there are several sightings, and local police are called in to investigate. And so they learn that two men are walking near a tavern when they see another man. He's wearing a black jacket. So one of the men goes up to the stranger and says, "Hey, what's your problem? What's going on?" The stranger doesn't respond. So this man goes a little closer and sees the man has no head.
What? Okay, that's messed
up. That's a little crazy. Yeah. The man then turns into a dog. It's very angry and big as a cow. At this point, these two men, GTFO, they run away. And it's around this time that the monster's seen by another group of people traveling along the same road. And they say he turns into a monkey and then is gone.
Oh, my God. What in the world?
Another resident reports watching the creature as it changed from a man wearing a suit into a pig. And yet another local sees it shift into a bat and fly away. So
man, bat, pig.
What the heck is going on? This monster is spotted near the tavern, as I mentioned. And so as a result, people are afraid to go back there at night. And also was spotted near a church, apparently peering through the windows during a service, but then vanishes by the time congregation comes outside.
Oh, my God. No. What's fascinating about this, a lot of cryptid stories, you know, involve individual encounters. Yeah. But here we're seeing groups of people.
It's a community, yeah.
Witnessing it. Yeah, that's crazy.
So this police officer that's often quoted in this story is Warrant Officer Zandisile Nalani. He's of the Eastern Cape Police. So he's doing a lot of the reporting out of these eyewitness testimonies and accounts that people are being shared with him. So the police are taking this seriously. They're looking into it. They're here and they're trying to figure out, okay, what's going on? Well, Nalani said that the community started dubbing the monster Bawakozi, which means brother-in-law. Sightings of the monster began, you know, are reported for about a month. I'm sorry. Sightings of the monster began about a month prior to that when it was seen by mourners attending two separate funerals. He said the community requested a meeting with police because they were frightened. So the police, as mentioned, agreed to work with the residents. But they're like, hey, we need some evidence. Can you take a photograph? Can you get some kind of evidence of this creature, this headless man who can shapeshift?
Pics or GTFO?
Yeah. Nalani did say that a photograph had been taken and shared of the monster resting under a tree. He said that when the photo was taken, the monster had been in human form, but when the photo was developed, an unknown animal was visible in the picture.
Oh, my God.
So,
wow.
Oh, boy. Nalani does hasten that, hey, although the creature has scared some residents, no people or livestock have been harmed. So, you know, whatever this thing is, obviously freaking everyone the heck out, but there have been no injuries or attacks or anything from it.
Right.
So after this rash of news reports, things just kind of go silent. So for about a month, this is going on and then nothing. So what the heck freaking happened? Well, I found some interesting potential explanations.
Urgot. It was Urgot.
It's always Urgot, right? Always
Urgot. Well, I gotta go back to- I always go back to your phrase that you used in our Dancing Plague episode. It was like, ergo, not Urgot.
Yeah, ergo, Urgot. Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. So there is a longstanding South African tradition and part of Zulu mythology of a creature called the Thokolosi or Tokolosh. Mm. And somewhat matches the description of this mysterious man-bat pig.
Okay, okay.
With some exceptions. So a Tokolosh or a Thokolosi are often called upon by malevolent people to cause trouble for others. At its least harmful, the Tokolosh can scare children, but it could even cause illness or the death of a victim.
Mm.
They're often said to appear as a brown-skinned man, hairy all over, it's very interesting, with only one buttock. They're also said to be very well endowed.
Hmm.
And nice. Another key feature, that is shared with this Stetlerville monster is the shape-shifting ability. So the Thokolozi carries a magic pebble that allows them to become invisible, but is also able to take the shape of different animals and can fly. Okay, ooh, so this is
so
interesting.
So that's the feature.
So that's a feature.
Yeah.
Well, so what can happen? This jealous person, this malevolent person, the story goes, can approach a witch doctor, an evil witch doctor, to take vengeance on someone. The client promises the soul of a loved one, but cannot choose who, as the Tokolosh will choose the soul it decides to take. It's very creepy mythology here.
Very much.
The witch doctor locates a dead body to be possessed, piercing the eye sockets and brain with a hot iron rod so it cannot think for itself, and sprinkling it with a special powder, shrinking the body. The Tokolosh is then let loose to terrorize its target, taking its payment of the soul of the client's loved one, weeks, months, or maybe even years later.
Very creepy.
Very creepy. So that's a little bit of some of that, again, tradition, mythology, particularly within the Zulu part of South African culture.
Right.
So let's say this is what's going on. What can you do? Well, the creature could be banished by a pastor and expelled from the area. One way to keep a Tokolosh away at night is to put a few bricks beneath the leg of each of your bedposts so that the bed sits up higher. There's a reason for this, because Tokolosh are said to be very small. So this is the one aspect that does not seem to coincide with this description of the Stetlerville monster, is they're said to be very small, little creatures. And the idea is if you put a brick under the bed, the feet of your bed, then it's high enough that the Tokolosh can't get you and kill you at night.
Quite small, like toddler small.
Yes. I think it's a great way to think of it. And so that's one way to evade the Tokolosh. Also, you can appease it by putting food out for it, but it can't be salted food.
Oh, okay. He's got high blood pressure.
You're not a fan of salt.
Got to look out.
Which I guess is a trait that's similar with European spiritual creatures.
You know, you see that a lot in just spiritual lore, the use of salt to repel bad spirits and things like that.
And then sometimes witches can subdue the Thokolosi and keep them for their own purposes. There's a combination of magic, luring them with food, and you keep them docile by trimming the hair over their eyes. Very interesting. Now, this is a bit of a side tangent from the Stetlerville monster, but it kind of ties a little bit back. So you talked about how in some parts of the world, even today, people have fires in, you know, kind of a common area, a hearth or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so this is interesting. Traditionally, many South Africans in areas where there's like a lot of Tokolosh myths slept on grass mats, encircling a warm wood fire that would keep them warm during those cold winter nights. But what was happening is sometimes healthy people would be found dead in the morning without explanation.
Oh, interesting.
So the theory is that sleeping close to the fire depleted oxygen levels, filled the home with carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is heavier, so it sinks to the bottom. Where the person is sleeping, they asphyxiate and die. So a healthy person or an entire family would be found dead. Well, what was happening was the thought that this was the Tokolosh. So what do? You prop yourself up higher with those bricks so the Tokolosh can't get you. What happens?
Yes.
You don't die at night. So it's this scientific explanation is also reinforcing the mythology, and thus the Tokolosh story continues. I thought that was so fascinating. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it is really interesting to see reality kind of reinforce, like the science inadvertently reinforces the conspiracy or the mythological belief, you know, because that's the proof they're looking for. But the science is not really looked at that way. So,
yeah, it's just an interesting revelation of like individuals, societies, like you said, trying to figure out what is seemingly random or not random, seemingly from a malevolent purpose or something like that, when we try to explain the unexplained in the world. And fascinating as it is, unfortunately, it doesn't shed much light at least for me, on what happened when residents encountered a headless man who changed shape and lurked outside of buildings. Was it a prank? Was it peeping Toms? Was it drunken misattributions to something that was rather mundane? Was it the Tokolosh? Or was it something else? Perhaps we'll find out one day who or what Baba Cozy was. But for now, it still remains a mystery in South Africa.
A mystery. And I went and looked up a really interesting illustration of a bed raised up by various household items like plant pots, cinder blocks, and things. And then the Tokoloshe is this little red with a long tail with long claws thing just trying to reach up to the bed, and it can't. And it's really, really creepy. Yes. I can't imagine the psychological impact of sleeping in a bed that's been raised that way so the little tiny evil monkey can't get you. Yeah. It's really, really scary.
And if you grow up with those stories and you grow up, you know, it's like a lot of folklore the world over, right? Like some people believe it, some people don't. Some people might, you know, be more scientifically minded, but still harbor these like, oh no, that's a thing. Like this is real. And to have that be, you know, a longstanding part of South African culture, you have to wonder if that somehow seeps into what these people were seeing that evening, that month or so when something was going on. But for it to happen and then vanish, it reminds me a lot of this story of Mattoon, Illinois, the Mad Gasser. And there was this like,
yes.
Again, we talked a little bit about mass hysteria before, right? And that's largely believed to be what happened there. We talked about it with the dancing plague. And was it a mass hysteria kind of event here? Like one story happened and then it kind of unwound, but then quickly went to the wayside. I don't know. There's not a ton of reporting on this outside of this, you know, small time frame. So it's really hard to say if anything else has come of it or if it's just a forgotten story.
Or, you know, people, when they stopped possibly sleeping in their beds raised up like that, or if they still do, if there maybe there are some households that that do, or maybe an elder relative did. And so that kind of. Because you're right. I mean, a lot of times these stories and these fears, these anxieties can be transferred. I'm always eternally fascinated by those shared ideas generating fear and superstition or just terror and delusion. It can really take any number of extreme, you know, usually in these cases of like folklore and cryptids and things like that, it's usually like more of a yeah, we pass this down from person to person. We tell the story. It's a shared story and has a ritual around it that just kind of alleviates that little itch in the back of your head. But we all have that. I mean, we all go to bed, you know, we could ask people, you know, we could take a poll, like how many people don't stick their feet out of the blankets at night because they don't want to be grabbed by something. I think that's a very, very common thing across cultures. You have so many people who are like, I'll never put my foot out. I defy all things. I actually sleep with my feet uncovered and the rest of me covered. So I'm kind of the weirdo of the pet, but I don't like having warm feet. Like I'm really weird about my feet being hot. So I it's the way to keep my body cool is keeping my feet out, but I'm always putting snacks out for the, you know, the monster under the bed and he hasn't eaten them yet, but we'll see. Maybe he's just not a foot guy.
You're tempting fate though. You're tempting fate.
Oh my God, this was so much fun. This little world tour, part one. And I hope that you all learned some things. And, you know, if you have any questions or you want to add to the myth, if you live in one of these countries and you are familiar with these stories, please reach out and let us know anything that you can offer. You can reach me through email at ddarknesstime@gmail.com. You can find me on the Facebook page for the podcast, Ding Dong Darkness Time Podcast. You can also reach out to me on Twitter and Facebook. I'm still hanging out those places. So go leave a comment. Let people know on the iTunes reviews and whatnot what you think. So, and then you'll need to tune in next week and find out what our top five countries yes. are and what mysteries we uncovered. I am so excited.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
Yes. So we will see you next week, ding dongs, and have a nice day.
Bye-bye.
Have a nice day. Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.